Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway. And Israel is on high alert. What do I mean by that? United States intel, according to the Times of Israel, is said to indicate Iran could strike Israel soil in the next 24 to 48 hours. Unprecedented, first time it would ever happen that Iran would actually launch from Iran onto Israel. Of course, they're worried about the Dimona nuclear facility. According to reporting in the Wall Street Journal relayed by the Times of Israel, no final decision is made by Iran. We are advising them, and in fact, the IDF says it's on high alert for the Iranian attack, and it has warned Tehran of consequences. Meanwhile, operations continue against Hamas in central Gaza. German police have detained three teenagers involved in an Islamist plot. All Iran's options for an attack on Israel and how Netanyahu could respond. A long story in the Telegraph this morning that is a lot of speculation, because Iran has missiles that can fly up to 2,000 kilometers. It's a long way. And Israel's got Iron Dome, David's Sling. They've got a lot of defensive weaponry as well. The United States had sent the CENTCOM commander, Michael Carrilla. He was the he knows the Middle East very well. So Michael Carrilla was in Israel yesterday conferring. The Wall Street Journal concludes Israel wins Gaza battles but risks losing the war. And the U.S. has asked China to not retaliate, to tell Iran not to retaliate against Israel. Got that? The United States asked China to ask Iran not to attack Israel. That's in the Financial Times. At the same time, U.S. vows ironclad defense of Philippines military in the South China Sea. So on the one hand, Joe Biden's team is asking China to deter Iran from attacking Israel. And on the other hand, on the same day, they're telling Japan and the Philippines, don't worry, we've got your back. Who's the superpower there? I want to play for you the current situation in Israel. I was listening last night to the Times of Israel podcast, What Matters Now. Amanda Dan is the host. David Horovitz, the editor of the Times of Israel, is the guest. Now, the Times of Israel has had a 600% increase in page views, because their landing page is fabulous. It tells you exactly what you need when you need to know what's going on. They have breaking news. They clearly, right now the headline is, U.S. intel said to indicate Iran could strike Israeli soil in the next 24 to 48 hours. IDF says it's on high alert. Netanyahu hints at retaliation. Russia, Germany urge restraint. Iran threat. Lufthansa extends Tehran route stay. And it goes on. Blinken urges China to use its influence to dissuade Iran from attacking Israel. It goes on. That's why it's picked up so much. Now, David Horovitz, I don't know where he is politically. I think he's probably to the left of Gantz. He doesn't like, he hates Netanyahu. Doesn't matter. He sits down with Amanda Dan and gives an overview of what it's like to manage the Times of Israel in this fraught period of war. And here's his summary, cut number one.
It's 6 months to the war, and I wonder, first of all, do you still believe that the war is existential?
I do. I think that that October 7th plunged Israel into an existential crisis. Just if you look at it in the, I suppose, what you might call the narrowest level, a neighboring entity. I mean, we call Hamas a terrorist organization, but it was a government that built an army and invaded from territory where we had no claim and murdered vast numbers of people in horrific circumstances, necessitated the internal displacement of tens of thousands more. Hezbollah opened up across the northern border with anti-tank missiles, for which Israel has no rocket defense systems because they have no trajectory, so they can't be intercepted by Iron Dome and that other range of defensive weapons that we have, and therefore that necessitated the evacuation of tens of thousands of people from the north. Many of the people have returned to the south, but many have not. It is not completely safe to live in that area, even though the IDF has been in Gaza for 6 months. Nobody can remotely contemplate safely returning to the northern border areas because Hezbollah has not been directly tackled in a significant way. It is still deployed very close to the border. Iran is circling, as we know, in the last few days and even hours. There's, you know, very, very serious talk about threats of attacks from Iran. I don't think the national sense of security has been restored. Many of the old divides that were very, very threatening even before the war about the nature of this country and where it's headed, the huge rifts have resurfaced. And in terms of the international context, our alliance with the United States is certainly under strain. The international community has shown spectacular and stunning intolerance for Israel's right to defend itself, which has real practical implications. There's a huge surge in anti-Semitism, and we are the nation state of the Jewish people. So it affects us directly. It affects us in terms of our absolute union and intertwinement with the Jewish world. So yeah, all of that to me adds up to certainly the worst crisis in the modern history of Israel, and especially because of the practical, real military threats posed by Hezbollah and ultimately by Iran, existentially threatening from a military point of view. Yeah, so yeah, I stand by that definition, I think.
I want to say, I think David Horovitz gave a great summary of Israel's position right now. And I recommend the Times of Israel podcast. You like, I recommend my own podcast, which is available at iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, the Salem Podcast Network. But I do follow podcasts a lot in the evening. Yesterday, Andrew McCarthy gave a robust explanation and defense of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which Republicans should vote for today under the rule that was passed. They do correct the abuses. The FBI is responsible for the controversy here because the FBI abused FISA. I did FISA warrants at the Department of Justice long ago and far away for two attorney generals. I reviewed them and would take them into Attorney General Smith and then Attorney General Meese. They came to me directly from the FBI. We never had one rejected. And boy, once you've seen it, you can't unsee what FISA does. And that was 40 years ago. We need FISA. We need to know about what terrorists are up to and what they plan. Dan Crenshaw makes a full-throated defense today, and I've retweeted it over at X. And I hope we understand. We would not be able to warn Israel right now of what Tehran was up to if we didn't have FISA. You understand that? We spy on people. We spy on foreigners. We're not supposed to intercept American citizens' conversations. They are sometimes involved in the intercepts. They may not be accessed. What the FBI did was unfairly access in Crossfire Hurricane when the FBI was out of control under Comey. So don't let that be your hangover. We need FISA. OJ's dead, and I don't care. I'm not going to say good. He's met judgment. I was on the air for all the time he was driving the Bronco 30 years ago. And I had to live through that. I was doing the nightly news and public affairs show Life and Times in L.A. for KCET, the PBS affiliate then in L.A. And Pat Morrison, Kermit Maddox, Ruben Martinez, and I would sit there and we lived the O.J. trial. I don't want to relive the O.J. trial. He was guilty, guilty, guilty. They had jury nullification for reasons unrelated to O.J.'s guilt. Yeah, he's a murderer, in my opinion. And you don't need a guilty verdict to say that. You don't have to say the accused. He was found liable for the death of Nicole and Ron at the civil suit. So he's not accused. He's actually found liable of the murder in a wrongful death action. He had subsequently went to jail. He did a lot of time, but he died at the age of 76 of cancer. Otani's interpreter has been charged with bank fraud for allegedly stealing $16 million. I want to bring this up because I've been speculating maybe he wasn't guilty. And maybe there was some gambling going on, but now I take that back because when you get charged, you actually stole the money. The Biden administration canceled $7.4 billion in student loan. No, they didn't. They transferred that loan to you and me. And they keep doing it, and they incentivize people getting 2 degrees and stupid minors. I'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Yeah, happy. Welcome back. back, America. That is okay by John Andrazik. Five for fighting. John joins me now from Israel. Good morning, John. How are you?
Hugh, good afternoon from Jerusalem.
I was wondering if you're in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. I've lost my feed in the return, so if the crew can put that back up. John, tell us about your trip. And you have certainly landed in Israel at a very tense time. Tell us how it feels and where you're going.
Yeah, well, I had a 6-day break from my tour, and a couple of weeks ago, some folks in Israel, where the song you just played, you know, has been resonating, asked me to come over, and I was happy to do it. And so we arrived a couple of days ago. Yesterday, I spent some time with the injured soldiers, many of the amputees, playing, talking, singing songs. Probably the hardest thing I've ever had to do, Hugh, I spent some time with the hostage family's two fathers and heard their stories and sat with them. Then last night I actually played in Hostage Square. I played Okay, a song for some of the hostage family members and many of the kind of folks who are organizing to support the hostages. And then today we're here in Jerusalem and kind of doing a lot of tour with some of the folks, you know, to see the history and, again, kind of just show everybody here in Israel that they're not alone and that there are some Americans that have their back. And it's been a surreal experience, and I still have, you know, 3 or 4 more days left.
John, I've only been there a couple of times, and I've gone up and down the country, though. How have you been there before?
My first time ever, Hugh. My first time, yeah. No, I brought my son, Johnny, because I wanted him to experience it. And no, it's. I just wish I could come under different circumstances and really immerse myself. But, you know, we're here for a different reason this time, kind of in a way, a diplomatic reach out. But, yeah, it's an amazing country. The people are amazing. The fortitude. You know, you see, you know, 18-year-old girls walking around in full uniforms and armed. It's just different than our world, and you hear about it, but until you come here and you see it, and you feel the fortitude of the Israeli people. You know, even in this terrible time, you know, they can find joy. And like last night, I was walking through Tel Aviv after I performed to the hotel, and we wanted to get something to eat, and we walked 2 miles and couldn't find a place because everything was packed. Everybody was outside, you know, talking, being with each other. So it's been an education on so many levels.
Who are you going to spend Shabbat with? Do you have any idea yet?
Yes, I'm with some amazing people, a woman named Aviva Klompas, who's been a warrior on social media, just trying to educate the world against all the misinformation that we've been hearing. David Azoulay, who's one of the biggest promoters of Israeli acts, and some friends that I've met. You know, I've met a lot of folks online, and I feel like I know them. And actually, I'm you know, meeting, having Shabbat with one of my Ukraine counterparts who we're trying to do this global, real the world type version of Okay. She happens to be here in Israel. She's handling the Ukraine part. So there'll be some Ukrainians, there'll be some Israelis, there'll be some Americans, and we'll certainly be grateful for what we have.
I'm going to come back to the specifics of your trip, John, but I do want to compliment you on calling out the music industry, which has been largely silent on the atrocities of 10/7 and the war of survival, the just war that Israel is fighting. Why is that, do you think?
I've been asked that question probably 100 times in the last 48 hours because Israelis are certainly grateful that I'm here, and the question is, where's everybody else? And I have no good answer for them, Hugh. It's a historical shame, and I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed of my industry. Of course, you remember the concert for New York, where I was honored to play a little bit, and every living icon, music icon, was in New York at Madison Square Garden, singing for America, singing for the heroes that ran into those buildings, providing solace for America and the Western world. And it's crickets. It's nothing. And many of them are, frankly, Jewish artists. You know, it makes me very angry. It makes me disgusted. It's one reason we're here. If everybody stood up for the right thing, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. I probably wouldn't be in Israel, but it is a historic shame, and I'm trying to do some things to address that, but there's no good answer, Hugh. It's
Well, John, let's explore that. What are they afraid of? I do this show 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, all over the country. Almost right. Every center-right person is very vocal in their support of Israel. Those that are not end up getting drummed out of the center-right movement and the conservative movement. What are musicians afraid of?
Well, you talk to some. I think, you know, some feel for their personal safety, and some feel for their family's personal safety. Some feel that their concerts will be protested. And look, I'll be honest with you. When Israel shared my video, and even now when they're sharing pictures of me here, I get a very small sense of what it's like to be Jewish. I get the threats. I get the vitriol. So I get it. They're scared. But this is what I say to them. I say, those are the exact same arguments people in your position used in 1938. Everybody was silent. And look what happened then. You can see it happening now. I think some of them, their agents are telling them you can't say anything. And frankly, tragically, I think some have fallen under the kind of woke oppressor versus oppressee cult mind virus. And they in their minds, find some moral equivalency between Hamas and Israel. And frankly, when our Secretary of State, Mr. Blinken, comes out and says if Israel doesn't change their ways, they may be indistinguishable from Hamas, that doesn't help, because it gives them a talking point. When you have the UN, basically a Hamas, you know, sycophant, that doesn't help, because it gives people, well, look at the UN. Look at, you know, President Biden hasn't mentioned the name of one of our hostages in months. So it's not just the music industry. It's our whole culture. And people in Israel are heartbroken. I'm telling you, they feel abandoned. They feel betrayed. And they think the world's gone crazy, because it has.
Well, you know, I wanted you to articulate it rather than put words in your mouth. I do think some of the artists are afraid, which goes to the bigger issue that Jewish Americans are afraid. For the first time in my lifetime, I'm 68, Jewish Americans have never been afraid of being, there have been anti-Semitic attacks, obviously, the Tree of Life synagogue mass shooting. There was a guy who went up to the center in L.A. and attacked it, and there have been a few anti-Semitic acts, just like there have been a few anti-Muslim acts. But, I mean, the fear among American Jews is widespread. So I sort of understand those who don't want the static at their events. I think it's cowardly. Those people are coward. But the people who are physically afraid, who are Jewish themselves, I get that, because for the first time in our lives, they're afraid that people are going to spit on them, attack them, hit them, ram their cars into them in America, not just in Israel, but in America.
It's insane. You know, I was very naive. I thought, with anti-Semitism, there were some kooks on the left, kooks on the right, but it wasn't entrenched. But how wrong we were. I mean, of course, our college campuses, our media, the House of Representatives, Elizabeth Warren, go down the list. You see that anti-Semitism is rampant, and it's so depressing. But at the same time, you know, if every artist came out and said, and they don't have to say, I love Israel. This isn't about Israel and Hamas. This is about civilization against those who want to tear it down. It's not about Israel. If they, you know, how come Barbara Streisand can't say release the hostages? Or, you know, go down the list, you know, Gene Simmons from Kiss. And it's not a Jewish thing. You know, one thing I say at every speech, every time I perform the song is, I'm not Jewish. You don't have to be Jewish to condemn Hamas. You have to be human. It's a human thing. It has nothing to do with being Jewish, Israeli. You know, when Hamas commits atrocities and kills babies and murders grandmothers and sends videos to their families, there's no context. That's just pure evil. And the fact that so many people are afraid to just say that has nothing to do with Israel. It's like, are you sane or not? And the world.
You know, John, you did perform at the concert for New York. Did you expect, that's in the aftermath of 9/11, he performed Superman. Did you ever expect that 20 years later, 22 years later, we would have people chanting death to America in the Detroit suburbs as we did this week?
No. It's you know, frankly, watching, you know, the way our colleges have been teaching this radicalism for decades, I guess we shouldn't be surprised seeing how feckless our leadership has been. You know, Hugh, we talked after Afghanistan, and one of our biggest fears was this is just a domino. If you abandon your citizens to the Taliban, who's going to fear you? It's going to enable the bad actors. So, and it's not just the Putins of the world and Khomeini. It's the people in the United States who have this visceral hatred for not just Jewish people. It's the West. They hate all of us. and the fact that our politicians placate to them. It's insane. I don't understand that the world's gone mad, but, you know, we have to take action, and that's what I'm doing. You know, you have to stand up to the bullies. I'm going to do a college tour when I get back. I'm going to Harvard. I'm going to NYU. I'm going to UCLA. I'm going to Cornell. I'm going to walk through the bullies, and, you know, we're going to sing the song, and we're going to put them on defense, because at the end of the day, we're in the right, and I think sometimes people just need to be nudged a little bit, and folks like you who have clear conviction, Mark Levin's going to be here this weekend. You know, and there's some on the, there's Richie Torres, you know, the Democrat.
Yeah, it's not political. Richie Torres is a man of the left, but he's a human rights advocate, as you are, as Mark is, as I hope I am. I got to ask you, when we go to break here, I want to find out what you're doing in Israel. But did you run into Ambassador Oren yesterday? Did you have a chance to catch up with him?
I am seeing him tomorrow, Hugh. I can't wait. We've been texting each other, and thank you for that connection. And I'm really excited to, you know, ask him all these questions about Iran and what's going on, and really get kind of the truth from one of the most, you know, smart.
Are you going to go up to the northern border? I don't know if you've done the tour of the kibbutzim that were destroyed and attacked by Hamas, but the northern border is an eerie place right now.
We're not going because of Iran. Certainly, that's one of the places that can be, you know, I'm learning everything about how many seconds you have to get to a shelter. You know, in Tel Aviv, you have 90 seconds. Where we are now, you know, less, you know, up at the northern border, you have 10 seconds. So I'm not here for a death wish. We will go to the kibbutzes. We'll go to the Nova site. But yeah, I'm on edge. You know, it reminds me of when I was in Ukraine. But just watching the people around me, I'm like, well, they can have a nice day. I'm enjoying the food. I'm enjoying the people. So I'm getting a sense of Israel as well as, you know, having this blanket of this war, and here comes the siren, and Iran kind of hanging over our head.
I'm going to talk with John Andrzejczyk during the break, unless he has to make a bolt for the shelter, and then I'll bring him back on the other side. Don't go anywhere, America. John Andrzejczyk live from Jerusalem this morning, or is it Tel Aviv? I think it's Tel Aviv. He's in Tel Aviv, I think. But we'll find out. He's in Jerusalem. We'll talk with him during the break. We'll put that on the podcast, Highly Concentrated View, available at iTunes, so you can hear the whole thing. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I am back now with John Andrzejczyk, who is in Jerusalem. John, I don't know how much of the standard tour you get to do. I don't know if you get to go into the tunnel next to the Temple Mount. I don't know if you get to go on the Temple Mount. I don't know if you get to go to the Dead Sea. You're not going to go to the north. But what is the mood on the street? Because Iran is threatening, and they have ballistic missiles, right? They can hit Israel, and there's Iron Dome and David Sling. But what is the mood among people? Is it just another day, or is this a specially tense time?
Unless you're like at Hoster Square or some of the places, you know, that really have a heavy weight to them, it's another day. And I had to come to your interview. I had to duck into an apartment of one of Panina, who's one of my hosts here, because her sister lives here, and one of roommates here is a, you know, very young 20-some-year-old woman who just got out of the military. And I kind of said, you know, are you worried? Or what's the vibe? And she's like, no, this is another day in Israel. They've been trying to kill us for 2,000 years. And we certainly kind of know what's going on, and we're aware. We also believe, you know, we have a pretty good defense system. So yeah, they're kind of doing their thing, and you wouldn't really know. You know, I'm certainly not like that. You know, I'm keeping my eye on everything. But yeah, I think they're just used to it, Hugh. I mean, it's like, and they find a way to have joy and do their jobs and get together and be diligent at the same time. It's something I've never seen before. And it's really incredibly inspiring. And I think, you know, as Americans, we can learn a lot from the Israelis.
Now, the Israeli political divides are deep as they are in our country. And they'll probably surface tomorrow night, as they have been surfacing on Saturday night. But I want to quote Yossi Klein Halevi, who's a man of the left or center left. And he said, this is not Netanyahu's war. This is Israel's war. Have you seen anything to contradict him, Sean?
Well, you know, you're starting to see a split with some of the hostage families. And understandably, it's been 6 months. The agony I saw in these parents' eyes, it's unspeakable. And so you're seeing a split of people who are really, you know, after the government to do something. They're frustrated. I understand that. And then you kind of see people who are, say, let's hold the course. I think they're frustrated that it's taking so long. So as you know, as wars go on, it gets harder to keep people mobilized, motivated. The splits start to come. So I think you're starting to see that. And of course, you know, I think the lack of support from the world, you know, they're more isolated now than they were. You know, every day they get more and more isolated.
John, I believe that more and more governments turn on them like the Biden administration has. But I don't believe that American public has turned on Israel. I think it's just remarkable how out of touch Blinken and Sullivan and, of course, the president's out of touch with everything. But it's just I don't think they reflect the world. I wonder if Israelis know that. 30 seconds to we come back from break.
I tell them that to you. I tell them that. I tell the hostage families. I tell the crowds. I tell everybody. I say, when I sing this song, which I have been doing the last 3 weeks, people say, thank you for standing up for good. They don't say stand up for Israel, for good. And I said, the American people has your back, even though our government, again, is performing a historical shame. But
yeah, it is. Hold on, John. I got to go to break. I'll be right back with John and Rozick from Jerusalem. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, John Ondrasik, the man who's singing there in the Five for Fighting hit, okay, is in Jerusalem. He's talking to me. John, I am curious. The American left doesn't think Israel is... The American left thinks Israel is too white. The fringe right-wing, ultra-right-wing thinks it's not white enough. That's a cliche now. What has been your impression walking around Israel? What surprised you about the nature of the people there?
It's all creeds and colors, you know, certainly. And also the kind of friendliness of the people. You know, when they take your order at a restaurant, they sit down with you. You know, they sit down with you. Even at the, you know, at the hostage forum where we're meeting with hostages and you know, the volunteers that work there, I can't imagine, you know, what their mental wellness is like. You know, they find a way to smile. They understand that they've been through this before and they'll come out the other side. And, you know, it's this complete kind of dichotomy of, you know, depression, anger, frustration, seeing what's happening to Israel and the world and how they've been abandoned, but also inspiration to seeing how they stand up to it and they keep moving and they still find a way to love and they have Shabbat dinner. But at the same time, you know, you have 18-year-olds walking the streets, you know, with AK-47s, you know, protecting their nation. So it's
now, John, really people will know this if they listen to my show. You have been a very, along with Gary Sinise and a few others in Hollywood, very active with our troops, with our wounded soldiers, USO tours, all of that. I am curious, when you sat down with the young soldiers who had been wounded at what is essentially their Bethesda Medical Center, their place where they take care of severely wounded soldiers, is it the same as talking to an American soldier in rehab and recovery?
It is. In fact, one of the soldiers I sat with yesterday was American, who came to Israel, American Jewish young man came to Israel to fight for his country. And, you know, I asked him about, you know, you're out there, you know, he was doing house to house searches. And he says, you know, many of the Hamas, you know, hide there. Many of the folks are sympathetic. And I said, don't you ever get angry? And you know, you could raise the houses, but you don't. You risk your life. And he said, yes, my commander was shot by a sniper. I tried to crawl out and save him, and I got shot 4 times. And I'm like, so why do you do it? He goes, because we believe in life. We have values. And it just reminded me of our American troops. I was actually wearing my Gary Sinise T-shirt when I was visiting Sheba. And they're young heroes. They give you hope. And, look, they're fighting for freedom. They're fighting for democracy. And they just remind me exactly of our troops. And it's tragic. But again, they give me so much hope, Hugh.
And last question, John. You are with your son. What's his impression of all this?
Well, it's certainly an awakening. He finds the Jewish women very attractive, Hugh.
Of course.
So he's enjoying that. He's enjoying the food. But, you know, he sat with me when we met the hostages, the hostage families. you know, he gets it. He's a fan of history, you know, touring Jerusalem today, going in the tunnels to the wall, kind of the weight of where we are and what's going on. And, you know, you learn that this is kind of par for the course for Israel. People have been trying to kill them and destroy them for 2,000 years. And for my son to kind of see that, I think you can't come here and not be profoundly affected. So he's immersed in it, and he's, you know, he's downstairs having a, you know, a beer and some falafel and the best hummus you'll ever eat. So he's feeling pretty good right now.
Yeah, if you run into Ronit and Yossi, who are old friends of ours, Ronit helped the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt out when my youngest was born 30 years ago for a couple of years. Wow. Then they went back to Israel. Say hello to them, because I know you're drawing crowds, and if you're at Hostage Square tonight, they'll be in a demonstration. John Androzic, thank you for going to Israel. Thank you for the song, okay? And thank you for joining me in the middle of your busy day. Say hello to Ambassador Oren for us.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you, Hugh.
We're experiencing instability at every level. Our government lacks leadership, and Bidenomics has been a disaster. The economy is in a fragile state. Inflation has been a consistent issue. High interest rates have put significant pressure on the real estate market. There have been major bank failures, and many analysts say a stock market correction is likely overdue. We have global conflicts in Europe and the Middle East that have the potential to spread, but gold has soared to record highs even amidst the tensions. There are so many reasons that Americans should consider investments in gold and silver, and Legacy Precious Metals is the gold standard. I love Legacy Precious Metals because of their zero-hassle, education-first approach. They can help you roll your traditional IRA into a gold IRA or ship metals directly to your house. Go to legacypminvestments.com to download their free gold investing guide. I've read it, and there's so much valuable information there. Friends, now is not the time to roll the dice with your hard-earned money. Find out about the growth potential that gold offers you. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today and tell them I sent you.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Israel's on high alert, as it continues to be. I check the Times of Israel every 5 minutes to find out if anything has happened. Nothing has happened. I'm joined by Ben Dominich. He is, of course, senior editor over at the, I can't even remember now, The Spectator, and Fox News contributor. Good morning, Ben. How are you?
I'm good, Hugh. This week really has been, sort of an interesting week, I think, for a lot of things finally breaking through. You know, including the story, obviously, that Hamas does not have the required number of hostages to meet the necessary demands of the Israelis when it comes to that side of things. And I think that the scramble on the right in America domestically over the abortion issue kind of broke open in a lot of different and challenging ways for them this week. So there's plenty to talk about today.
Yeah, I think former President Trump is right about abortion, and he's wrong about FISA. Let's start with FISA. I want this to pass. Andy McCarthy explained it. I used to do the FISA warrants when I was at Justice in 84, 85. We will be blind. We will be blind to the threats in the world if we do not reauthorize FISA Section 2, Ben. I don't think this is hard. What is wrong with the Freedom Caucus?
Well, I think that there's a lot of concerns left over from, you know, the experience that they've had in the past when it comes to FISA. And actually, Hugh, I was going to ask you about that, because I actually am. This is one of those rare areas where I'm just not sure that balancing the needs of the security state to defend America, and of course the concerns that we've had in terms of misuse of FISA in the past, I don't know that there's something that really solves the problem here. Without, as you said, leaving us blind. And obviously we can't do that at a time that, especially at a time that it's where the threats are so readily apparent for all of us in terms of what's needed. I don't know that there's a real balance in terms of overreach. The Freedom Caucus is responding, I think, to the concerns of their constituents who raise this as an issue of privacy, where they believe that this power has been abused in the past, and obviously particularly abused in the effort to go after Donald Trump and the people in his orbit.
Crossfire hurricane was a nightmare. Michael Garcia, great congressman from California, looked at Director Ray yesterday and said, I don't trust you. And that's basically what the country is saying right now. But if the people will listen to the McCarthy Report podcast, it's free. It's over at iTunes. Comes from National Review. Andy explained, this is not that section that was abused. And yes, people can abuse this, but Section 2 is what lets us spy on foreign terrorists. And we cannot not spy on them. and we just have to reform the FBI, not blind ourselves like Escalus.
And this is, I think this is kind of the big question, Hugh, when it comes to sort of going into this next election. You know, one of the things that we had a problem with in terms of the first Trump administration is that, I apologize, you're listening.
That's fine.
Listening.
We love the sound of children in the background.
My one-year-old Clover is very much interested in one of the toys she's playing with. The thing that I think we have to understand is there were a lot of points where Donald Trump would address a problem or identify a problem, and Republicans would act like just doing that was enough. You know, so Donald Trump comes along and he says he's the first Republican to really bring the level of prominence that is needed to the fentanyl crisis in America. And Republicans say, this is great. Finally, someone is talking about this. But does he actually solve the problem in the way that it needs to be beyond sort of hand waving at border issues and the like? I don't think he does, you know, in any real way. And I think that when it comes to reforming the FBI, that's the same kind of thing that we need to be talking about. This completely nonsensical idea that you're going to go in and blow up the place and not have America's enemies and criminals exploit what comes after is just absurd. And so instead, it needs to be a conversation about real reforms that actually give the American people the confidence that they need to have in such an important institution.
And I think those reforms are in this bill, but I want to move on to this story from The Economist that did profiling of swing voters, the people who are moving from Biden to Trump. It says those most likely to have swung from Mr. Biden to Mr. Trump are non-white parents of school-aged children. What's that tell you, Ben Domenech?
Well, it tells me a couple of different things, but we know, number one, it tells me that this whole push when it comes to the abortion issue on the Democrat side, the White House, is actually something that I think is only designed to motivate their base and not to bring those swing voters back. Those swing voters are swinging in that direction because they are completely over the type of indoctrination that they've seen coming out of public schools. They have a large amount of held over resentment from the way that their children were treated during the pandemic. They see the problems in the economy, especially for the working class, obviously. They see the inflation that's hitting them in the pocket every single time they go to the grocery store, which if you have children, you do a lot more than if you don't. And I think that that's something that really is, you know, needs to be the focus of the Trump campaign going into the fall, because it's all these different issues where the Biden administration just doesn't have answers for these people. Instead, they're doubling down on culture war policies. And look, you know, Hugh, I mean, I said this the other day, but I feel like Joe Biden and the Democrats are running on the idea that Hamas has the right to exist and babies don't. And that's something that I just think is absolutely that's a high end, like, you know, suburban white women, your PhD class of the Democrat Party and the basket weaving class that they have, you know, on campuses across the country, because they're so scared of those people. But those people are not the most of the country. They are the fringe of the Democratic coalition, even. And that's something that I think the White House doesn't understand, and obviously leaves a huge opening for Republicans to make inroads that they really have not seen in a very long time.
Now, Ben Domenech, because you were the son-in-law of John McCain, you know Arizona pretty well. The Arizona Supreme Court decision authored by Justice Lopez, I know him, and I've had lunch with him. He's a fine, fine justice, and he emphasizes in the decision, this isn't about anything except what the statutes say. And the statute says we don't create new rights, the new statute, the 15-week statute, that we're not creating anything. This is in response to, we want to get as many abortions banned as Roe will allow us to. Then Dobbs strikes down Roe, it reverts to 160 years ago. Arizona will pass the statute. I don't think people are stupid. I don't think they're going to fall for this. Arizona's going to pass a 15-week or a 6-week or an 8-week. They're going to hit the middle.
But Hugh, the media is bent on the idea that people are stupid.
Yes, it is.
Basing everything in terms of the assumption that they can lie to you and say, and treat this, by the way, as if it's a law. I can't talk to you, you know, how much I've seen, you know, the sort of coverage that basically says Republicans in Arizona pass a law. And it's no, the law is on the books. The court interprets the law that's on the books. They shouldn't create a new law. And that's not their job. And so it's the job of the legislature, it's the job of the people to actually, you know, adapt to this new reality. That's something that I think the average person does understand. But I think that for the sake of the media, they try to play this up as if it's something where, and again, this was the same thing they did with the IVF situation in Alabama.
Yes.
They said basically, these are Republicans creating law. And it's like, no, they're trying to interpret the law as it stands. And then the legislature can react as it sees fit, or the people can react as they see fit. The courts are not and should not be in the business, I should say, of creating new law. And unfortunately, this is a situation where every single time this happens, the abortion lobby and their allies in the media, they have their talking points straight. They have them in order, and they go rushing to every single microphone and TV camera and try to frame this as if it's something that Republicans are doing, as opposed to justices interpreting the laws that are on the books.
I'm talking with Ben Domenech, editor-at-large at The Spectator. You see him on Fox News. Ben, I want to just get your temperature right now. I think Donald Trump's going to win, because I think Joe Biden's infirm. I think everyone knows it, and I think they want to stand with Israel, and I think they are for common-sense abortion laws. I think he's going to win. What do you think?
I think if the vote was today, he would definitely win, and I think it wouldn't be close. I think it's going to be closer by the time that November happens, in part because I think the media is just so in the tank for Biden. They're going to do everything that they can to carry him over the finish line. And frankly, I think that the resource game heavily favors the Democrats in a way that, people really do not fully understand, I think, yet, but is going to become clear in terms of the coming months.
Now, I expect him to be convicted next week or sometime in May. We have a minute. Do you think that changes thing if the Alvin Bragg nonsense case goes through?
I do not think it changes one thing at all.
I think
that everyone has accepted at this point that this is an absolute witch hunt, type of targeting of a political opponent. And by the way, I think that it's something that has long-range ramifications beyond this in ways that I don't like to think about. I hope that it can be confined to this moment of hair on fire terror from the Democrats of Trump's return. But it is something that I fear is going to become, a norm, in a way that we do not like to see in American politics. It's something that is really a break historically with our past.
Ben Domenech, always good to talk to you. Follow him at B. Domenech on X. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to have you with me. Sarah C. Bedford is back from the Washington Examiner. She covers Congress like nobody else. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Can you bring us up to date on the FISA rule and when it's expected to be put to a vote? Dan Crenshaw being very explicit today about how it's got to pass. What do you say?
Well, it does look a lot more optimistic for those Republicans who do want to see it reauthorized with fewer of the strings that were initially under discussion. And that vote could happen as early as this morning. I mean, as early as a half hour from now, that could start to move forward. There were 19 Republicans who voted against the rule, sort of throwing a wrench into the procedural process of even moving forward with debate on this FISA bill. And so to appease them, the change was made in the Rules Committee last night to make this FISA reauthorization for 2 years instead of the usual 5 years. So sort of locking in the changes for the shorter period of time seems to be enough to sway some of those Republicans. And so the hope is that now the bill, at least the procedural steps to move the bill forward, can advance.
Now, Sarah, the hard left, the squad hates FISA, and the Freedom Caucus has concerns about FISA. But as Andy McCarthy explained in the McCarthy Report yesterday, we cannot be blind, right? If we don't have FISA Section 2, we are not watching the terrorists in the world to the extent that we can. I do not understand anyone opposing this.
Well, it's one of those interesting issues that's created a really fascinating bipartisan coalition, right, of the hard left and the hard right, and it's rare you see an issue that cuts across ideological lines the way the Section 702 does. And the main concern from those Republican hardliners, which it appears they're not going to get this demand, but what they wanted was a warrant requirement for if law enforcement was going to search those databases of the communications of Americans that do get swept up with borders. Because there have been issues of abuse from law enforcement officers who have pretty free reign to just conduct searches whenever they feel like it of Americans' data and communications, and they don't need a warrant if an American happens to have been communicating with the target of foreign surveillance overseas. So that warrant requirement is something that caused a lot of consternation among conservatives after Speaker Johnson appeared to flip-flop on it. It doesn't look like it's going to make it into that final FISA version.
Interesting, Sarah. I listened to the speaker. I don't think he flip-flopped. I think what he said is, I had no idea, which is actually what I say to people who've never had the sensitive compartmented information clearance, that, you know, even 40 years ago when I had it, it made my eyes roll back in my head when you see how many bad guys and gals are in the United States or want to come to the United States or commuting with people in the United States. I think he got the briefing, and I wish we gave that briefing to everyone, but apparently we can't.
Well, that's true. He did say that he received that briefing when he became Speaker of the House. That changed his mind. It's, you know, the conservative hardliners in the conference still have sort of viewed it as a flip-flop, and it's added to their skepticism of Johnson, even though Johnson is in a truly unwinnable position on this fight and most of the other fights. But, you know, to his credit, I think it does look like he is going to be able to at least clear this first hurdle with the bill without having to make a concession on that warrant piece. And he's also looking like he's going to allow a vote on a Warren Davidson amendment on this separate question of whether law enforcement can purchase third-party caches of data.
Now, the chairman of the Knucklehead Caucus, Matt Gaetz, is back in the news because apparently the allegation that he had intimate relations with a minor is still out there. What is the status of that?
You know, that had been dormant for a while, and I think it resurfaced when Kevin McCarthy brought it up and sort of blamed, now that he's able to speak freely, he's already lost the job, blames Matt Gaetz's concern about some sort of ethics committee investigation into that, and that's why Matt Gaetz rose up against McCarthy. I think that, you know, the way that the criminal investigation into Matt Gaetz was handled defanged a lot of these allegations, right? Because it emerged that he was under investigation that appeared to be a product of leaks. That investigation was closed without finding anything. There was a bad taste in everyone's mouth. And, you know, you're right, that those allegations sort of faded into the background because that seems to have been so mishandled. But that does not appear to be moving anywhere at the moment.
But it resurfaced this week. And I had no idea. I was traveling to Ohio, to Michigan. I had no idea where it came from. And it resurfaced this week. I thought maybe the Ethics Committee had brought something forward. Apparently not. Sarah,
brought it up, yeah.
Let me ask you finally. Has anyone seconded Marjorie Taylor Greene's effort to oust Speaker Johnson? Because that would truly be a demonstration of an ironclad commitment to being dumb.
It does not appear that that has any momentum at the moment. And even Marjorie Taylor Greene seems to be softened a little bit after meeting with him. So I do think that, you know, she sort of stands alone, even the Matt Gaetzes of the world don't appear to have an appetite for that. Matt Gaetz, just incidentally, is someone who voted against the FISA rule, and because of the changes that were made last night, seems poised to vote for it today.
Anyway, the Knucklehead Caucus, there's no predicting it, but they've got their counterpart on the left. Sarah Bedford, follow her on Twitter at Sarah C. Bedford. Thank you. The Hillsdale Dialogue is next, unless Iran lets loose with missiles, and I don't think they're going to. I'll bet you they do it during Shabbat, if they do it at all tonight. Stay tuned, America. I'll keep you posted. The Hillsdale Dialogue is next on The You Do It Show.